Well, good morning. It's Jeff Wine, host of The Car Show here on Sun Sounds Radio. Folks, once again, we've got an action-packed show for you today. Going to catch you up on the latest and the greatest of the world of the automobile. Well, you can see my voice is getting better. Last couple weeks have been pretty rough if you've heard The Car Show. So today we're going to talk about the oldest American car nameplate still in use, celebrating 90 years this year. I'm going to hold that for a second. I'm also going to talk about some car myths that when I read this, I was like, huh, I thought that was true. And in reality, it wasn't, about things to do or what not to do with your car. Of course, we'll talk about what's going on with gas prices. We'll also catch you up on what's going on with maybe some weird and unusual automotive news. And of course, it wouldn't be The Car Show without a little car talk. You know what to do. Fasten those seatbelts nice and tight. It's going to be a fast ride on The Car Show. Well, from the website Slash Gear, the title of today's article is, "This is the oldest American car model nameplate still in use today." Well, the oldest surviving American car nameplate is still used in today, celebrates its 90th birthday in 2026. According to its parent company, General Motors, the honor goes to the Chevrolet Suburban, which has been hauling people and their cargo for a period of 9 full decades. It's also made, you know, its only vehicle to have received its own star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame because it's been in over 1,700 feature films. Now, the Chevy Suburban's origin story harkens back to either 35 or 36 when the term station wagon was used to describe a vehicle that picked up passengers and their luggage at the train station, and then ferried them to their final destination via existing roadways. Now, these vehicles were known as Suburbans, a term used by several different manufacturers of this type of vehicle. The Chevrolet version was called the Chevrolet Suburban Carryall, which provided an enclosed 8-passenger steel body attached to a Chevy truck chassis. It came with a 60-horsepower engine, 6-cylinder manual transmission, for a whopping price of $675. Other options came later, with automatic transmissions being added in 1955, four-wheel drive being added in 1967, factory air conditioning, that's from the factory, 1965. And here's a fun fact, every Chevrolet Suburban, even from the first ones up through the 1966 model, only had two doors. The generation that ran from 67 to 72 had one door on the driver's side and two doors on the passenger side. And then from 1973 onward, all Suburbans had four doors. Now, over 90 years, the Chevrolet Suburban has been a part of the U.S. automotive scene, and there's been many generations of the Chevy Suburban. The power was provided, and the Chevy engine has grown from its original stove bolt 60 horsepower inline six to a 79 horsepower in 1937, 90 horsepower in 1947, and with the addition of V8 power options starting in 1955, starting with a 265 cubic inch small block putting out 145 horsepower, followed by the 283 V8 from 60 to 66, and then a 327 in 66. Now, the engine size increased further from the 67 to 72 generation of the Suburban. It's a 1972 model, small block 307, 327, and a 350 engine, while the 396 cubic inch big block was added for extra performance. The next Chevy Suburban generation ran from 73 to 91, a period of almost 20 years. Seeing addition of the huge 454 cubic inch V8 to its lineup, the big block mill continued from 92 to 99. Generation Suburban was a torque monster, which was ideal for towing, with a capacity of 10,000 pounds towing capability. Now, diesel engines improved fuel economy also added over the years, further beefing up the Suburban's ability to haul and tow. Now, chassis upgrades were also made over the time. Independent front suspension arrived in 1960, front disc brakes came along in 1971, and ABS automatic braking for all four wheels were added in 1992, and the Stabilitrack stability control system was introduced in 2000. Well, the latest generation of the Chevrolet Suburban which our review was found to have lots of power, comfort, and space, has been with us since 2021, and is the first to feature an independent rear suspension. The new 2026 Suburban, the latest version, offers three powertrain options, an optional 3-liter inline six diesel with 305 horsepower, while the other V8s are gasoline. The standard is a 5.3-liter, 355 horsepower engine, while the other is a 6.2-liter upgrade with 420 horsepower. Car and driver acceleration tests said the Suburban did, with the diesel engine, did 0 to 60 in 8.4 seconds, improving to 6 seconds with the 6.2-liter V8. Now, as you would expect, the Chevrolet Suburban delivers on the roominess for people and their stuff. Suburban provides 42 cubic feet of space behind the rear seat, with 94 cubic feet behind the, if you fold down the third row, and a massive 145 cubic feet with the second and third rows folding down. Prices start at $66,495. That's the MSRP, including shipping. While the Suburban is the oldest American nameplate still in use today, there's a British one that's been around longer, the Rolls-Royce Phantom, which is introduced in 1925. However, unlike the Suburban, which has been in continuous production since it appeared on the scene, the Phantom was not produced during the years of 1940 to 49, as well as a period from 1991 to 2002. Which actually means the Suburban actually leads the Phantom in the number of years that it's been produced. I can tell you this, folks. I know friends who have some of the older Suburbans from like the 70s, and they would not trade this vehicle for anything. And I had totally forgotten originally that this vehicle only had two doors, and then at one point in time, it had one door for the driver and two doors for the passenger. So the Suburban, the oldest American car model with the nameplate still in use today. Congratulations and happy birthday to the Suburban. Now, we all have those situations where, you know, you have an idea about how to fix a car or something to do to a car, and it was told to you by your grandfather or a friend, and there are myths about what to do with cars. And there's an article today that I'm going to read, Car Myths That Simply Refuse to Die. Well, as the driving culture continues to evolve, one would expect the knowledge to evolve with it. Well, that may have been correct for vehicles from the 70s, but it certainly hasn't held dear in 2025. For instance, the cross-drilled rotors may have been the best thing in 1950 to bring cars to a dead stop, but those are prehistoric today. Technology has evolved long beyond the need to cut holes in the metal, but the sentimental cross-drilled rotors still persist today, even featured in sports cars like Porsche and Lamborghini. This fallacy is a solitary example of myths about cars that endure. Some myths may hold water and specific contents, others are completely outdated, and a few borderline on fiction. A couple of these might cost you a fortune if you can still consider doing that. Well, it's 2026 and it's time to put some of these to bed. So let's look at some of these annoying myths that just don't want to die. The myth, premium gas is better for your car. Sports cars and a selected few like a Jeep or Wagoneer recommend premium gas as the best fuel for their engines. Performance was a key part of the experience for the speedsters, and the difference in octane between regular and premium gas can translate into slower acceleration. However, that doesn't mean premium fuel makes a difference for the every car on the road. Now, in the past, it was true when engines had octane specifications that what they could and could not run on. Times have changed, though. Modern engines instead have adjust their timing via control systems to prevent knocking. So your only distance you're likely to see over premium gas is when you put your foot to the metal from a dead stop. For cars that explicitly recommend premium fuel in their manuals, you'll do well to heed that. But lower grade gasolines could increase the threat of knocking. For the average Joe, premium gas isn't necessarily better for your car, and this is one of those myths that we need to stop believing in. You need to warm up your car before driving. Now, idling a car is one of those concepts that has refused to keep up with the times. Now, the origin isn't far-fetched to trace, depending on your age. You probably remember your parents letting the engines run for a few minutes before or after moving their cars. There's one popular one that says the weather switches from hot to cold. And again, in the past, the statement held some water. Older cars needed to warm up the oil to reach necessary moving parts because the lubricant was thick. Skipping this process risked engine stalling and engine damage. Now, fuel injected engines change the game in this respect. Lubricants flow much faster than before. Your engine only needs about 30 seconds to get fully lubricated. Lubrication is the most important part to driving smoothly and the engine being warm, and this could easily be achieved by actually moving your car around instead. You need to change your oil every 3,000 miles. Well, one of the traditions of car maintenance culture is the 3,000-mile oil change. Car owners are encouraged to change their engine oil every 3,000 to 5,000 miles as they drive. Now, this rule applied as a rule of thumb, and several factors are to determine whether your oil needs changing or not. Engine type, engine oil, and the manufacturer's recommendation should be taken into account. For instance, synthetic oil, which most cars use, can run no problem for 7,500 miles. Some new models post intervals of 10,000 miles in their manuals, while others say that their life oil monitor guide should tell them what their oil profile looks like. Besides these technological advances, the 3,000-mile servicing rule still persists. Now, this status quo could be attributed to drivers not wanting to rock the apple cart. For instance, if it hasn't caused any problems, it just makes sense to keep practicing it. However, changing your oil twice or even three times more frequently, according to the 3,000-mile stipulation, has real implications on cost savings. Coasting downhill in neutral saves gas. Well, you're facing rising fueling costs. It's only natural for drivers to look for ways to reduce their consumption of fuel. And the basis of this myth was rolling a car down the hill without the engine on. Well, from a logical standpoint, if you give an object a push at the top of a hill and it slides down at the bottom without needing extra force. Now, apply that logic to cars. If you have the belief that cutting the engine off will save gas, it's not true. Modern cars can detect that the vehicle is coasting in these situations, and the engine control module simply shuts off the fuel supply while you're going down the hill to keep the car moving. On the other hand, switching the car in neutral removes this ability. Instead, relying on momentum and conserving fuel, the engine continues to supply enough fuel to go into the idle mode. By following this myth, at best, you'll be using the same amount of fuel if you left your engine running, and in many situations, you could be using more. Well, driving without your air conditioning reduces fuel consumption. Well, the logic behind this myth is that using air conditioning puts a strain on the engine. Thus, cars use more fuel when the AC is running. However, there is some things to think about with this concept. In fact, it's not true in all situations. Fuel efficiency with air conditioning depends on the driving conditions, the degree of conditioning, the car speed, as well as aerodynamics. Now, a study from the U.S. Department of Energy used a Toyota Corolla and a Ford Explorer, both manufactured in 2009. And this is what they used to illustrate this. At lower speeds, up to 60 miles an hour, the Corolla with the AC on at 50% power, driving with the windows down, was more fuel efficient. For full blast duty cycles, using the air conditioning became more efficient around 75 miles an hour. That's because the higher speeds, drag forces increase significantly. Now, the Ford Explorer yield different results. Using the air conditioner at full power used more gas at all speed levels and at 50% duty. The car needed to be going 80 miles an hour for fuel consumption to be more efficient. To summarize, the fuel efficiency with air conditioning depends on the type of vehicle you have, but a blanket statement, well, this is false. Inflating your tires to the max PSI can cause a blowout. Now, most cars come with a recommended maximum pressure, a figure typically located on the sidewall. It's widely believed that at this PSI, your tires are at a higher risk of encountering a blowout because the max PSI on the tires often exceeds the recommended amount stipulated by the car manufacturer. At these elevated levels, car handling can be compromised and a stray pothole could blow out the tire. However, this is a false perception. A burst of pressure of the tire exceeds the maximum PSI can count on for some distances. The max PSI simply indicates the pressure at which the tire will carry the most amount of weight. In fact, for specific vehicles like SUVs, the car needs to be supported by its tires in the proportion of the weight it's carrying, especially if the load is exceptionally heavy. To meet these load requirements, the tires may need to be pumped up to their maximum sidewall allowance. You'll also do well to be mindful of potholes. As mentioned earlier, you don't want to go over above the max PSI too much. Overinflated tires wear unevenly, even around the center, and significantly reducing the lifespan. Electric vehicles are more fire-prone than gasoline-powered vehicles. Well, fires are scary. First, one of the cons you'll most likely come across while researching EVs is the fire risk. Part of this fear comes from the relative novelty to fire departments. EV fires last longer and are more difficult to put out. A regular gasoline car requires somewhere between 500 and 1,000 gallons of water to extinguish. A leaf engulfed in a fire could require up to 45,000 gallons of water. Now, these incidents stick out in memory, but one must consider what specific fire departments encounter an EV fire. There are various ways to put out an EV fire. Current data estimates it takes about 2,500 gallons to extinguish an EV fire on average. We've also seen various ways to put out an EV fire. In terms of frequency, data from Swedish reports saying EVs are actually less likely to catch fire than regular combustion engine powered vehicles. Now, the Swedish Public Safety Agency, and they were looking at 600,000 EVs and hybrids driven in Sweden in 2022, with the average of 16 EV fires per year. That's a 1 in 37,500 risk. Gasoline-powered cars actually have a 1 in 1,300 odds of catching fire. Judging from these metrics, the EV risk and for fires is greatly unfounded. Pickup trucks are good in the snow. Well, snow is a tricky terrain to operate in. You could lose your grip or get stuck, or even starting your car in cold temperatures can prove challenging. And for some reason, however, there's a belief that pickup trucks handle these adverse conditions better than regular vehicles. Now, on a regular surface, pickup trucks do handle very well, and they're sturdily built and have ground clearance to navigate obstacles that could cause problems to sedans or SUVs. In reality, it's a different story. The weight distribution is a problem for pickup trucks, given the physics. A truck bed is so much lighter than up front. Some drivers solve this problem by adding some weight to the back or deploying snow tires to provide better traction. But the fact is that pickup trucks are not excellent choices to drive in snow across the board. The distinction belongs to four-wheel drive enabled pickups vehicles, not just pickups. The four-wheel drive distributes power to all four wheels, which translates to better grip in slippery conditions. Perhaps there's some association between four-wheel drive and all pickup trucks. That's why this myth has persisted so long. Nonetheless, a blanket statement is totally false. Oh, and I've had my friends tell me about this. Red cars are more expensive to insure. Now, of course, I have a red Corvette, and people go, oh, those attract policemen, and those are more expensive to insure. Well, several factors influence insurance rates, including type of car, age, and credit history. And for the longest time, drivers in America have been convinced that the color red is one of the rate deciders. Now, it's really unclear how this myth was born. Perhaps there was a subconscious correlation between red cars and reckless or aggressive driving habits. However, the data does not back up this bias. White cars are likely to be more likely to be ticketed by law enforcement. In terms of theft, flamboyant colored cars are safer than neutral cars, so it's not if red cars are an elevated risk of being stolen. Now, truthfully, a car color does not feature in insurance premiums. According to Bankrates, most insurers don't even ask what color your car is. However, while the car color may not be relevant, custom paint work might influence the car rates. Custom paint jobs qualify as custom parts or equipment, which translates into additional coverage, and the extent and the type of power that the car has is probably more of a deterrent on how expensive your rates are. You need all-wheel drive to drive in the snow. Another popular winter tale about driving the scene of an all-wheel drive technology is to navigate these roads. A Hollis is supposed to grip the slippery surface if you're not putting power to all four wheels. Well, all-wheel drive does help you move, and it's a big selling point is its grip. However, power is evenly through the tires on the ground. You'll get into sticky situations. You'll be moving all right, but it doesn't aid in steering. There's only so much grip the tires can use, and if you're overconfident in your driving and your front tires could lose traction, you could have understeer. Snow tires do a good job of providing grip just as well and adding extra coverage in braking and steering situations. You don't necessarily need to have all-wheel drive to drive in the snow. Now, very slick situations do require a lot of traction climbing up hills, and all-wheel drive does make your life easier. But however, it's not all-wheel drive or bust, as the marketing campaigns would make you believe. So there's some of the great stories and myths about automotive. There's still a couple more, and I'll bring those to you next week. For some weird and unusual automotive news, we're going to come to NASCAR, and it says NASCAR postpones the Clash until Monday due to a winter storm. Well, the Cookout Clash at Bowman Gray Stadium has been postponed until Monday due to Winter Storm Gianna, which is dumping snow across the southeast. The race will be featured on Fox broadcast, and that will be held at 4 p.m. Arizona time tomorrow. There's some pictures of the stadium completely engulfed in snow. So snow postponing a NASCAR race? Oh, that's weird and unusual news. There's actually a video online with one of the drivers from Joe Gibbs Racing taking to the racetrack, which is covered in snow, in a all-wheel drive Toyota Camry and sliding around the track. And this, folks, this looks like there's probably at least 8 inches of snow covering this track. So no NASCAR racing tonight. It's going to be tomorrow. Gas prices with our friends at AAA. Right now, the average gas price in the United States is $2.87 a gallon. Here in Arizona, $2.98. New Mexico, $2.62. Colorado, $2.59. Over in Texas, $2.47. In Oklahoma, how about this? $2.38. And of course, our friends in California paying a lot for gas, $4.34. Let's see what's going on here in Arizona with our gas prices. Well, once again, our friends down in Tucson have the best gas prices in the state. Sam's Club at $2.28, the Shell Station on Speedway at $2.29. Oh, the Fast Trip in Casa Grande at $2.37 a gallon, and the Arco in Marana at $2.39. All right, let's see what's going on with our gas prices here in Metro Phoenix. Well, the cheapest gas prices in the metro, you're going to have to head over to Apache Junction, $2.59 at the Marathon on Apache Trail. The Quick Trip in Gilbert on South Val Vista Drive at $2.61. The Love's Travel Stop in Chandler at $2.69. And the Arco Station on 43rd Avenue at $2.69 as well. So, yeah, there's definitely plenty of gas out there that would be, I would consider, less than $3 a gallon. We've come to that time of the show. It's time for a little car talk. Dear Car Talk, my ownership of cars has ranged from the Dark Ages, a 1966 Triumph Spitfire, to the Space Age with a 20 Chevy Bolt and a 22 Outback. Those latter vehicles suit my needs and my wife's as we enjoy our retirement years, but one thing I'm not enjoying is the movement toward touchscreens. Now, back in the Dark Ages, if you wanted to turn on the radio, you pushed a button. You wanted to change stations? Same thing. What about the heat? Well, except in the Triumph, you slid a lever across a slot located in your dash, and you could do all of this without looking down. Fast forward to now. I find myself taking my eyes off the road to find the screen that controls whatever I want to control. Aim the tip of my finger to the exact spot where the option is, and then Watch to make sure that I hit the right spot that registers my input. It more often takes more than one prolonged glance at the screen to locate the climate control selection, change the temperature. About 3 weeks into the process, the car beeps at me and flashes a sign that says, "Keep your eye on the road." Well, if I wanted to be told that I'm driving poorly, my wife is right there in the passenger seat to tell me. Now, in terms of it seems that I've been repeated focus on the computer screen creates a dangerous driving condition. What are tips that you would offer to ensure adjustments can be made while paying full attention to the driving activity on the road? And second, is there any chance that automakers might transition back to switches and knobs and slide bars? And that's from Dave. Well, first of all, Dave, I agree. It is dangerous, and some manufacturers tout voice control as an option, but anybody who's lost a fight with Siri will know that this is not ready for prime time. Other than that, there's not much you can do to mitigate this trend except wait for the car makers to get over their infatuation of putting everything on a screen. Now will we go back to all knobs and all sliders? No. The computer screen allows us unprecedented customization. If you want orange decorative lighting in the cabin instead of purple, you got it. That's never going to be controlled by a knob. It would be used too infrequently, and it would take up valuable cabin real estate. Now, I do think that smarter cars will go back to more harder knobs and switches on commonly used features. I would count on things like the volume and tuning and mute controls, temperature and basic climate controls, and other hard navigation buttons for key areas under the screen, home, map, entertainment, etc. If you want that stuff to use multiple times per trip, will be available at your fingertip to use by feel without having to go back to the screen. I do predict the pendulum will swing back this way for two reasons. First, people are revolting. I know I'm revolting. My wife tells me that. Secondly, I think the movement will start back with luxury cars. Because you know what's not luxurious? Poking your finger on a cheap screen. You know what is luxurious? A well-made knob that feels great in your fingers and turns with precision. And that starts with luxury cars. And then it generally finds its way into all cars. Hopefully, your next car will be better. Good luck, Dave. And folks, I totally agree. I've got a fully analog pickup truck because it's a 2009, so I don't have any of those issues. Now, my 2017 Corvette does have a touchscreen, but that's just for the entertainment situation, not for everything, even on the entertainment. It has nothing to do with the air conditioning or heat, so I feel very blessed that I'm not using a touchscreen with everything I'm trying to do in my car. Well, folks, that's all the time we have for the car show today. We'll meet you back on the radio again next Sunday. This is Jeff Wine, and you're listening to Sun Sounds Radio of Arizona.